This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Steve Almond has been called a candy freak, a humorist, a satirist, a sensualist, a novelist, short story genius, essayist, teacher, charmer, and gadfly. But the label he wears most enthusiastically these days is traveler. He just hustled into our studio moments ago after driving up from Wilmington. Visiting Wilmington from his home outside Boston, leaves here for a tour of North Carolina, sponsored by the North Carolina Arts Council. He'll visit nearly a dozen places in the Tar Heel State, and he's going to promote his new short story collection called God Bless America. He's also been touting the pleasures of working with Lookout Books, a literary imprint at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Steve Almond, welcome back. Good to have you here.
You don't know how good it is to be here.
Steve called us about 2 hours ago and said, how long does it take to get hit there from Wilmington?
Was that 45 minutes?
Something. 2 hours and a half, we said, but you made it, and that's good. God Bless America, the title. Are you being ironic here?
I am not, sir. I am. I couldn't be happier to live in the United States. This is a country with the. I could only do what I do and certainly make the meager living I do in this country, I think, writing short fiction and essays. I'm an absolute believer in. The ideals of America, and they're the best that history has come up with, that we have a species has come up with. I will say that it's an aspirational title. I want to feel that we're living up to those ideals, and we don't always, and it's heartbreaking. It's a lot of what's in the book.
When you listen to, I don't know how much of the last segment you caught because you were in your car and trying to get here, but the difficulty we have when your patriotism drives you to call a warning about an engagement that may hurt a lot of people and in a heartfelt way say, this may not be the right thing to do. Yeah. When you hear the stories of those who have served and the heartbreak that they've endured, right. Well, it's almost hard to raise the question because you know what they've been through, right. And you don't want to say, gee, maybe we shouldn't have fought this war.
Well, I actually, on the contrary, what I say is, oh, my gracious, look at all this human damage, and we just see a sliver of it. I mean, the great tragedy of living for the last 10 or so years in this country is we have really offloaded, you know, we've privatized the trauma that war inflicts onto this tiny, slender little portion of the population. But you cannot send 19, 20, 21-year-old kids into extraordinarily violent, morally incoherent situations and expect them to come back undamaged. It's just absolutely, and you can't just clap for them in airports and wave flags and say, thank you for your service. These guys have to figure out how to live again in a culture that is unbelievably self-absorbed. We're so impatient. We're like, hey, we have to wait 5 minutes at the ice cream parlor. We're ready to go nuts about that. And these guys have been in, you know, just unfathomable situations. And I was listening very carefully to this segment, and I just thought, this is the reason that there needs to be real moral oversight of how these are real people we're talking about.
So you have a couple of stories that deal with veterans. The First Aid Back, I think, is one we'll talk about right now. Tell us a little bit. Set that story up for us.
Really, it's a real simple story. It's a number of veterans from Iraq, young guys who are just returning on their flight. It's their first date back, literally, in the United States. And our protagonist, Tony Tedesco, sees a flight attendant, beautiful flight attendant, and in his own disturbed way, he just immediately decides he's in love with her and proceeds to pursue her with increasing sort of alarming vigor as the story progresses. And you come to realize slowly but surely the specific episode in the larger war that he's haunted by.
Will you read for us?
Absolutely. Her name was Valerie. She was from Elkhart, Indiana. Her dad had been the coach of the girls' basketball team on which she had played all 4 years, though she'd also been runner-up for prom queen, a fact she mentioned with some embarrassment only after Tedesco pressed. She had been a flight attendant for 2 years. She wanted to see the world, but foreign routes were based on seniority, so it might be 20 years before she got herself assigned to Europe. Mostly, she said, she saw airports and hotel lobbies. She was 24 years old. Tedesco said he understood. He'd considered the army for much the same reason. He had a friend, Andruzzi, over in Germany, who told him you could go anywhere you wanted if you could arrange transport, Paris, Amsterdam, Brussels. Then 9/11 happened, and he'd felt, you know, there was a greater responsibility to the whole thing now. Tedesco didn't tell her that he'd actually enlisted 3 weeks before 9/11, that he'd done so because he could see that if he stayed in Providence, he'd wind up with a crappy Muni job and his mother's nagging. He didn't even like to think this way. He loved his mother. She had suffered enough. He could take care of her now. The prospect sickened him. They shared a taxi to her hotel, the Marriott. He told her he had a room there, too. Total coincidence, so she wouldn't think he was some kind of stalker. It wasn't just physical desire. There was something blooming inside him. He asked her again in the lobby to have dinner with him. "I'm supposed to meet some of the girls," she said. "You can see them any time," Tedesco said. The darkness outside loomed. He had pills to put himself to sleep, but it kept taking more and more to get him down, and he woke up to the world groggy and alarmed.
Steve Ullman reading from his latest collection of short stories, God Bless America, that one, First Date Back. You used the phrase a minute ago, two phrases, in fact, moral incoherence and incredible violence. Tony Tedesco comes back. He refers frequently to his family members, his uncles. He's trying to make sense of it. His whole world has been turned upside down, and he's trying to reach these reference points, touch them to get some sense of grounding. It's just not there for him.
You know, the thing that isn't discussed a lot, and I'm glad the last segment touched on, is how incredibly lonely it is. I mean, America's a lonely culture to begin with, but how lonely it would be for the formative, central, emotional, and psychological experience of your life to be this utterly traumatic, agitating, I mean, the kind of anxiety these guys are living with and are haunted by, for that to be sort of the transcendent experience of your life. And then you're supposed to go from that constant sense of dread, adrenaline, total boredom, which is another part of the military experience, this myth that you're going to see foreign lands, you know, and you're just, it's going to be glamorous. And what it is utter boredom followed by chaotic terror, short spurts of chaotic terror. And to come back to the world we live in, a world of traffic jams and malls and frantic buy messages, and to try to reintegrate, it's not just that it's difficult. I think a lot of these guys just feel terribly alone.
Well, and if you think about it, our integration into that society, I think that a lot of your stories are wildly comic. They display your sharp wit and, I think, keen eye for what the American scene. It's narcissism writ large. It's greed that it doesn't even recognize itself because of its own narcosis. To adjust to that, to be adjusted to that may be a kind of sickness of its own.
Well, I think that Americans and this is the underside of America for me, as much as I think it's ideals. I mean, look, when America wants to make moral progress, when the people of this country want to make moral progress, they do so. Abolition tells us so, suffrage tells us so, civil rights tells us so. But I think we are in a period where Americans are so lonely and so far from their internal lives and really in many ways from their family, very disconnected. We're moving so quickly through time zones and through, sort of this abject consumer culture, and people feel really lost and atomized, and they are searching for some sense of connection or communion, and it makes them in a sense easy prey to people who say, here's who you should be angry at, here's who you should be aggrieved by, rather than saying, gee, we've got some real problems we got to solve. And it's heartbreaking for me. I think a lot of the stories, some of them are funny because I think that's the best way you can contend with tragedy. But there's a darker edge that I think comes from living in the United States for the last 10 years and just sort of absorbing it.
Well, Tony Tedesco makes reference to when people always want to hear the war stories. And he says they live vicariously through him. We've become zombies. We are the body.
He calls them vampires. And there's that sense, when I listen to these guys, who are cheering for war. Can you imagine, Frank, such a thing as cheering for a war? Could anybody who's ever lived through a war cheer for that? Such an occasion of massive trauma to everyone involved. I mean, look, honor it. The experience that your last guests were talking about, people need to recognize what these guys have been through. And that's not by throwing a rally. That's by sitting down and listening and helping them sort of sort through it and experience and re-experience what they need to before they're going to be able to work it out. You can't just wave a flag or slap a bumper sticker on your bumper. That's the worst part of America, the part of America that thinks you solve problems by mouthing the right slogan or assuming the right posture that appeals to really the childish impulses inside us.
It's another wall. It's another way of keeping yourself, as you just suggested, keeping your distance from the actual pain.
Right.
So we'll celebrate something called victory. That right. I think a lot of these guys who come back, when you talk to them, when you go down to Fayetteville, they never talk in terms of winning and losing. Once they come back out of that situation, it's the people at the airport who've
That's right.
got the
it's,
flag.
It's too real for them. And part of the reason that I think that these veterans keep cropping up in my work is, you know, I'm part of the 99%, to put it coarsely, who aren't exposed directly. And it's the guys and women who serve and their families that are directly absorbing all this trauma. But I'm part of that's just seeing it. But I do teach college, and I teach a lot of kids who are 19, 20, 21 years old. And I remember teaching them when war was declared on first Afghanistan and then Iraq, and thinking, my God, these fragile young guys are guys their same age are heading over there with rifles into these situations where people are trying to blow them up. And just trying to imagine, what would that do to somebody who's still just forming as a human being?
The title story, God Bless America, I think deals directly with this question of getting in touch with who you are and living a kind of direct experience, albeit a comic one, as an actor tries to connect with his inner self.
Well, he's not really an actor. That's the thing. It's a story. Billy Clam, the hero of that story, is a guy like all of us who is going in search of himself. And he is he's kind of spiritually dead inside. And he finds acting. He wanders, stumbles into this acting class. And suddenly the teacher is speaking in a way that's saying, do you feel disconnected? Do you feel a sense of drifting away from your one and only life? And Billy has this revelation. It says, I'll be an actor. But I think we're doing that all the time, trying to sort of reinvigorate and sort of face our internal lives. Billy does it, I think, in a way that's kind of archetypal because he's a dreamer. He's a Walter Mitty.
Yeah, well, there's a wonderful line, if I may render it, sure. from the story. He talks about a couple of the first gigs he gets, including a gig with a tour operator, Sammy Duck.
Yeah.
And he said, being a Sammy Duck tour guide was not technically an acting job, but it had elements of the craft, such as speaking before a captive audience and interacting with other guides at red lights.
Yes. I mean, do we live in our circumstances or do we live in our expectations, in our dreams? And the truth is that most people, I certainly feel like I live in my expectations. I live in my fantasy of how it's going to be. And so, that's why Billy, even though he's, total schlamazel, I love him. I want to rescue him.
Is the occupation – you have blogged about the occupation movement, and you see a great deal of merit in it. Is it a thing that can bring – because, politically you may or may not agree with what's being said there. But what you're saying is something so much deeper, that we have to get in touch with the agony that is our brothers and sisters suffering and not cheer for one side or one political solution. Is that just another kind of loudmouth cheerleading chorus?
Well, look, I always have people who say, oh, you do all this political writing. And I always want to say, what is it going to take for us in this country to be able to speak about morality? What is it going to take for us to strip away all the – because that's what, frankly, both sides, but the right really specializes in saying, oh, well, you have a difference with me? It's just political. And I say, no, it's actually moral. I'm just concerned that somebody, Steinbeck, why does a man need 100,000 acres of land? What would a man do with all that land? There's no answer for that question that makes sense to me when we have a poverty rate, we're not educating kids, and not doing the things that an adult, mature, decent culture would do. These are principles that Christ set out quite clearly in the Sermon on the Mount. He was a homeless pacifist, frankly, who flounced around the Sea of Galilee saying, blessed are the peacemakers, and, give to those who have less, and the meek shall inherit the earth. I'm not saying anything that Christ didn't say, and he said it quite eloquently and quite directly. And for me, the great mystery of our political discourse is why there isn't more of a basic moral statement. I think the guys and women who are out there in that Occupy Wall Street movement aren't political types. Okay, this isn't AstroTurf corporate sponsored. These are Americans who are saying, what has happened to the American dream? Why do we live in a culture where there is such abject greed, and abject greed is rewarded at the expense of the most vulnerable in the society? It does not feel like a complicated message, and it's not a political message. It's a moral message.
It is a moral message. It doesn't seem complicated, and it kind of seems obvious when you do the math in many ways. Why do you think it's possible for those people with that nearly 40% of our – that 1% of our population that owns 40% of our wealth, 40% of the wealth and 1%, we know that. Why would it take so long for people to say, well, maybe we should at least look there for the answer, not make an accusation? Because it does seem that mm-hmm. so much of the blame is being put on the most vulnerable.
Right.
Well,
I think,
is that possible?
I think part of it is that people are not great students of history. And I don't want this to seem political, but, you know, America's boom years, the post-World War II years, when good old Eisenhower was president, the top tax rate on the top earners in this country was 91%. And they knew that Uncle Sam was going to take their dough if they didn't do what? Build factories and hire workers, reinvest that money in the economy. And as a result, we had the boom economy, greatest boom economy of our history. And if you look back at history, even recent history, every time we ask those at the top to pay a little bit more, because it's not even because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the most effective thing to do, to have the society that creates opportunity for everybody, not just those who are lucky enough to be born, you know, in good circumstances. Every time we've done that, the economy has responded. And somehow, I mean, the real answer to this, I think, is that the political system has been capitalized and monetized in a way that I think all Americans across the spectrum feel is crooked and out of whack. And until that fundamental problem is addressed and people say, let's actually let morals be our guideline, not who has the most dough, but who has the best and most sensible and humane ideas, I think we're going to continue to struggle. But I feel like a day of reckoning is coming, and I long for it. I wish to be able to bless America in that way.
Something else has happened in the meantime, because back in those days that you were talking about, when you said the economy, you were talking about not only industry but also the workers who actually created the value and created the capital. These mm-hmm. days you can actually have a Wall Street go wild, and those people who created the value say what they've, in terms of zombie economics, you want to talk about disconnecting one from the other, they've become unhinged in a way it wasn't true.
Well, we've sort of put late model capitalism is like a centrifuge. It whirls around at incredible speed, and the wealth concentrates at the top into and that wealth is not just wealth, it's power. And even though we've identified those folks and their various endeavors, it's quite difficult. You know, it's like turning around a battleship for us to start to say, now listen, it doesn't seem to be working particularly well, because anytime you're opposing the status quo, you go up against all the power of the status quo that's trying to hold on to systems that ensure their wealth and power and so forth. And, you know, that's a part of America that we are still reckoning with. It's just as if when we make these decisions to go to war in ways that I think morally don't take into account the great cost that's going to return to us, it's a place where we just have to improve. And my feeling, although I'm sometimes heartbroken about it, and I'm certainly trying to express the book, is, look, Americans are decent people, and they might be benighted in certain ways, but they want to have a country that they can all feel, you know, proud of and can feel as sort of realizing the moral promise that was set out 200 and some odd years ago.
Is that the start of the thought for you when you write these stories? They're so craftily put together, and obviously you think deeply about these other issues. What comes first for you when you
character,
write these stories?
Character. You know, I always just think my sense of plot is really pretty primitive. Find a character, push them into danger, and stay with them when they get into that danger. That's where everything interesting happens, you know. The poetry's in the precision, but it's also in slowing down when a guy like Tedesco is really up against it. And it's frightening to do that, because this is a culture that, as we sort of heard in your last segment, has a lot of unbearable feelings, and people are really trying to stay away from them and hope that maybe the next purchase will give them the shot they need to sort of work out the stuff that inside of them that is really oftentimes deeply troubled, as chaotic as a veteran. I mean, I think everybody has a rich, inner, tormented internal life, and they're trying to figure out ways to face it, but they're also terribly frightened. Our job as artists is to look at those unbearable feelings, not to wallow in them, but to make everybody feel less alone with that kind of internal chaos. That's all I'm trying to do, is sort of stay with them in those moments where it's all bearing down on them, because that's frankly what I need, just to not feel like a freak.
Well, thanks for slowing it down and giving us that vision, Steve. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Steve Allman, author of many books, his most recent, a short story collection called God Bless America, Going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill with the co-founders of Lookout Books this Saturday, November 12th at 6 o'clock. Steve's also going to be at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh on November 30th. And you can find out more about Lookout Books. We didn't even get a chance to talk about that in Wilmington, but we are out of time. So we're going to talk about Lookout Books down at UNC Wilmington. But you can find out more if you go to lookout.org and find out more about Steve Almond at stevealmond.com. Coming up on The State of Things, Catherine Whelan is here with her Fascinators. They'll play live. Please stay tuned.